Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello, and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is Richard Price, the author most recently of Freedomland. He started out with The Wanderers, and then came Blood Brothers, Ladies' Man, The Breaks, and the last book was Clockers. The book is published by Broadway Books. I think this is an astonishing book, and I'm very happy to have had it to read. You know, it's not very often for me that a book that it looks like a thriller is as intelligent, as dense, and as, you know, full of unusual information as this. And I wanted to ask you how long it took to write, first of all.
Well, the book began with the Susan Smith indictment in fall 1994 for the killing of her two sons. I'd been sort of wandering and floundering for a couple of years before that in terms of what to write about. And when that hit the papers, something got to me. And I went down to South Carolina in the fall of 94. What happens with me is I start taking notes and I start just hanging out with people. And at some point, this note-taking evolves into some kind of first draft. And that first draft continues more note-taking, more first drafting. I'd say from the time that I left to go to South Carolina to the time I had a first draft done was about 2 years, and then another year to get it to the printer.
To my mind, the most exciting thing about the book is what differentiates it from the Susan Smith case. In the case of Smith, you've got a sociopath, but in the case of your heroine, Brenda Martin, you've got a kind of passive, grief-filled Helen of Troy-like beauty who flits around the scenes and doesn't really have the ability to say very much. The quality of passivity is very strong in her. She seems like your most interesting character.
I basically was interested in the juxtaposition of a person who's like invisible, is almost gray, is almost opaque, who's an outcast from a white blue-collar town and has sort of fled to the black housing projects on the other side of the city line. Basically, she feels like an outsider, and so she's throwing in her lot with the other outsiders. She works in this after-school program, and basically she just has created for herself a life in which she basically hides out with her child, who's her only ally, her only friend. And one day she just sort of steps in it, and because of all the little life lessons, all the little clicks and clacks that life has taught her and how to act and react, she panics and just says, you know, that one thing, that world popular, ever loving, hottest item in this store, a black guy did it. And she's as aghast as anybody's because she's about as bona fide committed as an outsider can be to this project that she's just put under the torch. And I wanted to create a situation and an individual that would really intensify though and widen that DMZ between whites and blacks. Plunk her in the middle, yet anyone who gets near her, although their first impulse might be to wring her neck for what she has brought down on these two cities, they spend any time with her, and they can't help but feel her humanness. She's not a monster. She's not pathological. They don't know what's going on with her. They don't know what the story is. They know she knows more than what she's saying. But there's something about her that brings out the humanity in the people that are around her. And people find it very difficult to stick to their side of the color war because this woman is demanding of your sympathy and pity and terror, and she gets it.
I wanted to talk to you about certain qualities of your writing that have always been there. From the very beginning, there's the interest in the language of the streets, and your ear from the start is very good. How did it develop?
Well, okay, I mean, we could talk about it as dialogue and attraction to writing dialogue, you know, but more specifically what you're saying is the argo. I grew up in the Bronx in a working-class housing project, and basically everybody spoke like everybody else. We didn't know we were from the Bronx. We didn't know we lived in a housing project. As you know, it's like some kid once said to me in Cincinnati, "I didn't know I was an Appalachian American until I read it in a paper." you know, you live where you live, but once I left that environment to go to college, I went to Cornell and then further out to California, and you kind of get scared and insecure about this new land that you're in. You kind of retreat to what you know, and I got more streety and Bronxy than I ever really was in the Bronx. But as a writer, you know, it's, I guess, you know, you can live anywhere you want, but you're always only from one place. And for me, it was that. And in my writing, I would always go back to that tone, that sound, those rhythms.
Well, it seems to me that you must have been a phenomenon from the first, because I remember somehow there was a quote by John Fowles on one of your first novels. And I thought, how did that show up there? Usually you
Dark
don't...
Side of the American Dream. Yeah. You got me. I didn't see... Now, that's the funny thing. Like, you were talking about Hubert Selby earlier in Last Exit to Brooklyn, which is probably the most important book I read when I started even daring to think of myself as a writer. I mean, that was the most liberating thing I've ever read. From the outside, I mean, you know, it's so easy to romanticize the other. Now, I know, you know, he says, well, I'm writing about six Gavons from a Bronx housing project, pre-Beatles, pre-Vietnam, pre-dope. And, you know, it's fairly, you know, like up until about 64, it was still the 50s, really. And then it all changed. And John Fowles, when he said that, the kids like the kids that I was writing about in The Wanderers had not been seen between the covers of a book for quite a while. Studs Lonergan, Last Exit to Brooklyn. And so it's the novelty of, like, white working class kids, a novel, proletarian novel, but it was the 70s. And when people aren't... But when I grew up there, I didn't think of it as the dark side of anything. You know, I could play that card, you know, for drama when I was at Stanford and I was, you know, kind of, like, feeling insecure. I could make it sound like I came from Hell's Hundred Acres. But by and large, it was, you know, it was a solid working class knucklehead environment. You know, everybody went to school or had jobs. Divorce was a scandal. Drugs was unheard of.
But there were books like that. There was The Blackboard Jungle. There were, you know, things of novels of the street. But somehow or other, you caught on in a literary environment first, which was very unusual, it seems to me. And I wondered, who were the teachers at Cornell, for instance, who you were working with then?
Well, Cornell, I was at Cornell from 67 to 71, and I got a degree in industrial labor relations. Now, if you ask me anything about arbitration and mediation, we have to terminate because I cannot answer. But I was always taking electives in creative writing. And at that time, the class of 1959 at Cornell, it was a bumper crop. It was Thomas Pynchon, Ronald Sukenik, Joanna Russ, Steve Katz, Richard Farina, and I'm sure I'm forgetting some people. But, you know, there was a significant number of novelists that evolved out of that one class. And a handful of them came back to teach.
Who was that?
Ronald Sukenik was the first real live writer I've ever in a room with, a published writer, and he was a really old guy. He was in his early 30s. You know, to me, it was like he's a writer, so he's got to be at least 140. But you know, he cursed in class, and he had this arcane reading list, sort of like an anti-fiction list. I mean, all. Well, everything on that list was something from Evergreen or Grove Press or New Directions. And I didn't understand a damn thing on the list except Henry Miller. But it was, I mean, it was more, he never said anything to me that, you know, he never taught me anything. I mean, nobody can teach anybody anything in a creative writing class. What they can do is validate that you should continue doing what you're doing. But it was just like being in the room with him. Knowing he was a writer. Oh, this is what a writer wears. Yeah, and writers can say the S word and the F word in class, and it's cool. You know, it was the hippie time, too, so it was really kind of like... we had guys coming into class. Remember a guy read a whole bunch of pancake poems. He wrote poems on circular pieces of paper, poured syrup on them, and ate them. And that was, like, average. you know, behavior.
I'm speaking to Richard Price about his new novel, Freedom Land, from Broadway Books. What I notice in particular, what seems to me amazing about these things, is that even Elmore Leonard and the other practitioners of this form, the kind of social thriller form, you've got in your scenes three or four centers of action. So the scenes never quiet down. Foreground becomes background. The eye for detail is constantly searching. The scenes keep coming at you with another rush. And I wondered how you structure that. It just seems so amazing to me.
I really can't answer that. I mean, I sort of, you know, I'm not even aware that I do. I'm not trying to be disingenuous, but I'm not even aware I do that. You know, I basically cherish details. I cherish visual non sequiturs. I really believe in if you want to write about the world, take a tiny chip off the periphery, and it'll just replicate and replicate until you've got the whole world in this tiny little odd non sequitur that is really like a metaphor for so many bigger things. I guess at this point it's just a conditioned roaming element that I have in me.
Because, you know, as you go through the book, you see again and again, toward the end, when and outside of City Hall, points of view are focusing back and forth. The woman reporter knows that if she looks at the cop's eyes, who's sitting on the podium, that she will know from his eyes what's going on behind her in the audience.
Right.
There are different ice flows of this glacier breaking off and breaking into activity simultaneously. And when I compare that, for instance, with the scene when the same reporter goes into a bar that's being used by the media to congregate, she's looking for one of two people. Her eyes are on them, but she's got her cell phone in her pocket, and that's going to ring any minute. But they're recognizing her as the woman who's been with the chief suspect. And so the scenes keep moving around, focuses of visual activity, and really, you know, if you think of, for instance, a screenwriting precept, one point, one scene, one point, one scene, these scenes erupt.
Well, I mean, once again, I can't, you know, it's... You know, I go out there, I hang out with people before I write about them, and I don't have any questions for them. I don't want their opinions on big issues. I don't care if they think O.J. did it or not, you know, or yes, I know it's tough to be a cop. Yes, I know it's tough to be a single parent, family head. But what they can say to you or the general things are in a way so less interesting than in these little telling flicks and gestures and tossed off comments that for me just kind of like explode in my head. So there's nothing little to me. I mean, it has to play little because, you know, it's going to get crowded on that runway. But, you know, everything there is big, you know, and I like playing on three, four different levels, you know. And at this point, I guess I've been doing it so long, I guess I'm fairly fluid at it. I have a terrible fear of being boring, you know. Which can be counterproductive in a novelist because, you know, I write like I'm sitting on a hot stove and I can't get off until I finish the paragraph, you know, which is not that great. But, you know, if I am going to write a big fat book, it better be interesting.
Well, it never stops being interesting, and it keeps having for me the energy, say, like when you're a kid and you're reading Rambo or William Burroughs or Henry Miller, that kind
or
of...
Serling.
Yeah. Well, not for me. The kind of energy of someone who knows the rhythm of things and how to, you know, you're like a rarity show barker. There's something astonishing, even when you're talking, the amount of energy that you're putting into the rhythms of what's going on around you.
Well, terror keeps you slender, you know. I mean, literally, I think some of that is like sheer anxiety. You know, in the process of writing, you know, it's so hard to sit down and get started, and so hard to be still and quiet. You know, that you know, I feel like I'm physically snapping and popping all over my body, but when I'm finally seated and not allowed to snap and pop anymore, then it all comes out my hand, you know, onto the page. You know, but it's almost biological.
How do you get it all on the page?
Get
all of your inflections, because you do, these are pages that just
throb. I'll tell you, the other great influence for me, other than Hubert Selby, was Lenny Bruce. And I remember being on a Greyhound bus going up in my senior high school, going up to Ithaca, New York to have an interview to try to get into Cornell, and I got a paperback book. It was The Essential Lenny Bruce. This is not, his autobiography. This was tape transcripts of his routines and monologues. I have never physically heard Lenny Bruce. I read these things, and it was like home. Once again, it was like, I know this rhythm. This that sort of brilliant mock non sequitur, because it really isn't non sequiturs, spin out of details and metaphors and similes, and everything, no matter how far they go, they always come back and enhance the central image. And it just sounds like the guy's just blowing smoke. But everything out of his mouth is on the money. And everything, no matter how disparate it sounds at first, ultimately enhances the central theme of whatever he's riffing on. Basically, it was the whole idea of what a riff is. And I just recognized it. Sometimes you don't read to learn things. You read to recognize things. I mean, I think the recognition is 9/10. I mean, comedians, they basically, their entire stock is in their ability to make people remember and recognize foibles. What's Seinfeld? It's all about, just getting three socks out of a dryer. Where the hell's the fourth sock? Everybody knows that. Somebody sees you look like they're picking your nose, but you really weren't picking. It's all about, yeah, I know that. And Lenny Bruce not only made me feel that, but made me recognize the art behind spinning out like that. And I could do it. I just knew I could do it right away.
Do you feel like a channeler? Are you a medium? What's the thing?
It's what I do. It's who I am without even thinking about it. I mean, it's like, some people just know how to run fast. They're real fast. You can't teach them that. They were born with it. This is something I was born with. I just know it. It's like, to compliment me on it is like to compliment a woman on being beautiful. It's like she didn't do anything. She was given that. I was given this ability to like spin out. That's my, it's like a sparkler.
Well, I always think, it's a little pretentious, but I always think that we all have gifts. But then there's figuring out how to use them, and then figuring out how not to misuse them.
Right.
And all sorts of people. You could be a brilliant con. I'm sure you were. There are ways in which we all throw our gifts away until they're taken from us. You got yours, in spades.
No, but the thing with this stuff is if that's all there is your ability to, do these great words, free associations, and you're a novelist, it's all... You're going to sink like a stone. There's no there. It's got to be applied against a greater, a deeper bedrock. Like in Freedomland, I'll have guys, do all this, informant talk or cop talk or, street baloney talk. But it's always got to be like the top layer underneath a whole strata of moral and social and political things that are going on. If you don't have that bedrock underneath this facility that I have, that's all it is a facility. So Freedomland, it's about, a lot of people ask me, well, look, you obviously lead a quite different lifestyle than the people in the book, all right? I write screenplays, I write books, I live in Manhattan. I have 15 smoking jackets. No, I'm like, six or seven cummerbunds and ascots. No, but nonetheless, obviously, my life is like more like a downtown Soho-y kind of like lifestyle. All right, so what's in it for me with Freedomland on a personal level, other than like, okay, this is where I'm from. This is where I am from, and this is what has happened to the world from which I grew up, housing projects circa 1960. Wow, this is housing project circa 1997. It makes Clockwork Orange, look like a cartoon. But there's another thing that is sort of cross-cultural, cross-racial, cross-economic, cross-class, and that is parents and children and the feeling and the fear of loss. If you have children and you love children, there's a little part of you that dreads the loss of them, which is inevitable. They're going to grow up. I mean, that's that. And I guess somewhere I was trying to tap that feeling of like, well, now they're 11. I remember when they were 5, I said something I shouldn't have said, or I didn't say something I should have said, or she needed me at that one point. And I kind of knew she did, but I really had other priorities at that moment. And the older they get, the more painful these sort of flashbacks become. And so for me, it's kind of like this feeling of like, how can I, you know, they're still here. I can make it right. I mean, I'm not saying I was a bad parent or anything, but, you know, you always could be better. And for me, it's like this perpetual feeling of like recognizing things I wasn't aware of that I should have been aware of. What can I do to make it right? And then also recognizing, well, I'm not that much different than I was when they were 5, and I feel bad now, but an hour from now, I might want to be doing something else, and I'm going to be, you know, doing the same thing that made me feel bad about what I did 7 years ago. You know, I'm human, you know, and it's like right now I'm hitting this wave of remorse. But, you know, it's for me, it's like a struggle. You know, you want to hold on to them. You want to make everything good. You screw up. You can't help it. Loss. It's just loss. Love equals loss, you know. And so, you know, it's like a sand clock, you know, having children. And, you know, 13, 15 is 2 years from now, 17 is 4 years from now, and they're gone, you know. And I think and some of that sort of fueled this whole thing of a child abduction, which is like a physical disappearance, obviously something much more dire and concrete. But, you know, even the black detective, Lorenzo, trying to get this woman to open up, talks about his own son in jail, keeps offering himself to her in hopes that she will reciprocate and keep talking until she says what's what. Well, and all of a sudden he winds up in hell because he's gone too far. He's told too much about himself.
Well, her children seem to turn up here. One of my favorite sections, because in a way it's getting over the top, but it doesn't go. There's the Friends of Kent, and there are a bunch of children there with different kinds of deformity, Down mm-hmm. syndrome, and there's almost like a parade. There's been, throughout this book, the imagery of the death of children, a bunch of refrigerators in a at the central lawn.
Crates laying out there.
Yeah, that all the children can climb into, and they look like this sense that the whole world is full of children who are poised to be hurt, either biologically or by the lives they're leading or by the people around them. The constant threat to children seems to animate the prose.
Well, you know, I mean, yes. I mean, there are people that are, you know, this group, the Friends of Kent, it's a group of housewives that have sort of organized themselves as child hunters with some success over a number of years, and they're kind of pros right now, and they know what they're doing. And each and every one of them has some connection to a child that is either is no longer among us or he suffers from some birth malady. And it's just all kinds of loss and all kinds of fierce protectiveness, you know. And I'm not 100% in control of what I'm doing either. I mean, you know, some of this stuff is you're going on automatic pilot. Something feels right. Now, if you try to do a whole book because it quote unquote feels right, it's going to be a bloody mess. But you got to allow sometimes, you know, to just sort of trust. There's something right about these people being in here. You know, you got to trust the way what your mind is being, picking up like a magnet. You know, it's doing some of the weeding for you. It's like telling you what's important, you know, in a way that you're not aware of. It's just like you feel emotionally, oh, I could really get into these people now. Yeah, well, gee, no wonder. I was writing 300 pages about a child who's missing. It's about, you know. But it's a world, like the whole world is, in this book is sort of like fueled by pain. I mean, everybody's hurting in this book.
You know, I got to tell you what talking to you feels like. I used to be friends with Ray Sharkey. He was born in Red Hook.
Yeah, no, he's great. Yeah, I remember the Idolmaker, yeah.
Yeah, and every moment that he, you know, a lot of people had trouble with Ray, but I loved him. I thought he was great. And every time he'd talk, he was so busy feeling that there was no distance in him whatsoever. And women would feel it around him, and the great thing about Ray was that no matter who the woman was or what she looked like or what her age was, if he felt her zoning to him, he would pay her the attention of the world and then move on to the next one, of course, and the next one and the next one. Now, he took the fall, you know, in the long run. I mean, this is a guy who, you know, came back a lot of times, microsurgery in his eyes and all kinds of stuff. But he fell. What keeps you going? What prevents you from going over the edge?
I think, hey, I'm, you know, like a low middle class kid. I'm a good boy, you know, ultimately, you know, little drug problem here or there. But I would prefer to live forever if I can. Thank you. And I know this just sounds hokey, but I got kids, you know. And kids, in a way, are like the greatest police in the world in terms of, you know, making you want to straighten up and fly right. And I don't want to sound sentimental about it because it's anything but sentimental to me. You know, it's kind of a sharp feeling for me. But, you know, I want to be productive. You know, beware what you wish for, you know. I mean, you know, guys will burn out all the time. I mean, everybody has, at this point, through AIDS or some kind of drugs or something. I don't know anybody who doesn't know at least a handful of people that should be with us that are dust, you know, Ray Sharkey among them, you know. I don't want to go that route. I mean, I have things I want to say. I want a life, you know.
What seems great to me is that when I first read The Wanderers and Blood Brothers, I have to confess, I would say too sentimental.
Too sentimental for me either, yeah, too. Yeah. I mean, either too, whatever.
But what amazes me is that without losing your sense of what makes people cry, you seem to have gone beyond that so that you're not tugging on the sleeve anymore or imploring. But nevertheless, that is the ground rock of what you do.
Well, I mean, the books are like very emotional, basically because I have to pump myself up to do the work. And I'm not a clinical writer. I'm not a person, you know, who's interested in sort of reinventing the structure of the novel. I am not interested in ideas. I feel like I'm sort of like condemning myself here. But basically, I'm not interested in, I'm not a philosopher. I'm not into the ideas of how we use language. Basically, I'm a storyteller. And it's hard work. And I got to be jazzed to do the work I have to do. And I think it comes down to, you know, I mean, maybe I'm like the last of the Depression era social realists or something. But basically, I'm a storyteller. I love details. I love the way people talk, you know. And if I can work things up into, you know, sort of a dry froth, I mean, it's an oxymoron, I'm sure, but I will. I mean, it'll keep me writing, you know. I'm not a cool customer.
I've been speaking to Richard Price about his terrific recent novel Freedom Land, published by Broadway Books. Thank you for joining me.
No, you're welcome.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Special production assistance today from Alan Howard. Development by Beverly Walker. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse. Wow.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.